Hey guys, welcome to Crystal Kyle and Friends. Today we have a very special episode. In fact, there is no intro that we're doing because we're sure we could hold a very good, solid, and long conversation with this professional that we have with us today. So big welcome here to Anna Kasparian. She, of course, is the host and main producer of The Young Turks. Anna, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to see you, Anna.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, of course. I thought we could start with a little bit of political and also Gaza-Israel talk. I just want you to opine on whether you think Joe Biden is directly throwing his election away in order to enable a genocide in Gaza.
I definitely think that his unwavering commitment to Israel's far-right government, regardless of what it does in Gaza, is threatening his chances of getting reelected. And the fact that he's doing so really diminishes the argument that he's running on to begin with, which is you must vote for me because if you don't, our democracy is on the line. Donald Trump will dismantle our democracy. First off, if the Democratic Party in general genuinely believe that, I would argue that they would not insist on running Biden for re-election. He was already unpopular to begin with, but there is growing rage in the country, especially among Democratic voters and independent voters who lean Democratic in regard to how Biden has handled this war in Gaza. They want to see conditions for the military aid and the weapons transfers that he's engaging in. And even after the very intentional drone strikes, three drone strikes that took out a humanitarian aid convoy and killed seven international aid workers, the Biden administration remains steadfast in doing additional weapons transfers without any strings attached, without any conditions.
So is it like I'm at the point now where I don't even know if it's possible to change Biden's mind and his policy on Israel? Because to your point, when you have a situation where there's a giant logo on top of the car for the World Central Kitchen, they bomb that and then they bomb two other vehicles knowing that there are civilians in there, knowing that this guy's like aligned with Western NGOs and he's big in like the resistance liberal Hillary Clinton type circles. And were still like, go ahead and pull the trigger. So given that fact, given now it's over 40,000 Palestinians dead, about 15,000 kids dead and all the targeting of civilian infrastructure, do you think there's anything that could happen that would make Biden say, okay, we're going to cut off the money and we're going to cut off the weapons? Because I'm at the point where, I don't know, I mean, he's tanked in the polls completely. Michigan, you know, and Wisconsin, there's very clear, like, uncommitted group that's screaming from the rooftops, you have to stop doing this. And he's still just not budging even an inch. So is it possible to get him to move his position on this at this point?
If I had to bet money on it, I would say no. I don't think that there's anything that Israel can do to convince Biden that he needs to pivot to, you know, having conditions for weapons, for using his leverage with the weapons, of course, to pressure Netanyahu to engage in a ceasefire. And I think, you know, obviously, I believe that the United States government has leverage when it comes to this war. Biden is unwilling to use that leverage. But one of the things that also kind of stands out to me about this situation is that you see Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, have a very clear interest in keeping this war going so he can maintain power. Mm-hmm. And so it's amazing to see the prime minister of Israel willing to do anything and everything to remain in power, whereas our president, Joe Biden, is willing to risk it all on behalf of Israel, knowing full well that he risks losing re-election and losing power. So it just gives you a sense of how powerful the Israel lobby is. And I want to be clear that the Israel lobby, you know, lobbying groups like AIPAC are not the Jewish lobby. These types of lobbies typically have many evangelical Christians funding and supporting them. And, you know, it's just like any other powerful lobby in the country, right? They've got the funds. They do their campaign contributions. More importantly, they threaten candidates or incumbents by you know, threatening to run a candidate against them and spend hundreds of millions of dollars to do so. And so as a result, you get this incredibly pathetic behavior from lawmakers and incumbents, including, by the way, Senator John Fetterman. I mean, no one has been more embarrassing in my mind than John Fetterman has been. You know, it's one thing to be so terrified of AIPAC that you just remain silent in your critique or criticisms toward Israel, but he's become a full-blown, you know, a hardcore Zionist simply because he's terrified of AIPAC running a candidate against him. It's just so, so sad.
And I think at this point, with him and Biden in particular, I actually think it goes beyond just like the corruption of money. Because especially almost with Fetterman, because to your point, there are plenty of other members of Congress who are corrupted by the Israel lobby money who don't feel quite the same need to go out there and just every day cheerlead in the most indefensible possible way, who just, you know, are there on the votes. They do everything that AIPAC wants them to do, but they're not making a point of making that their whole brand. And so I've sort of come to the conclusion, you know, with Fetterman, I don't think he's long time in this position, but I think once he came out in that direction and got this pushback, it sort of like hardened him, like, I'm going to be the most pro-Zionist person on the entire planet. With Biden, you know, he's an old guy stuck in his ways. He's got this view of Israel that he formed in 1973 or whatever. And I genuinely think, I don't think there's any other conclusion you can come to that I think he believes that Trump is a real threat to democracy. And I think he thinks this is even more important to that for whatever reason. You had a report I just saw, which is insane. Yeah. I saw a report today that according to Joe Biden himself, his own wife hates his policy to Israel and has been begging him to stop it. Did you see
this? I didn't see this, no.
So he had that meeting with Muslim American leaders because they wouldn't join him for iftar. So I had to cancel the iftar and just do this meeting with them. One doctor walked down. Another doctor showed him photos from her phone of starving Gazans that no one had ever seen before because they were just from her personal, you know, photographs. And he said, oh, yeah, I've seen those before. And then he told the group that his own wife has told him, stop it now with regard to the war. So when you look at all those things, I just have to come to the conclusion, it's actually beyond the money, which is, it's so locked in and so hardened that I don't know what could possibly move him off this position if even his own wife being on the opposite side of it doesn't budge him at all, except for maybe a little bit rhetorically.
Well, you know, if that is in fact the case, and I do think you make a good point here, then to me, you know, really either situation is awful because it communicates to the American people and to Democratic voters that the lives of one group, in this case, Israelis, happen to be more valuable than the lives of innocent Palestinians in Gaza. And so as a descendant of people who were basically victimized by a genocide, the Armenian genocide of 1915, I can't look at what Biden is supporting. I can't, you know, experience Biden being so careless and flippant about the lives of Palestinians and still support him. I get that he's done positive things during his administration. You know, I think his National Labor Relations Board has been pretty fantastic. I love that Lina Khan is the head of the Federal Trade Commission. I think that, you know, Biden deciding to work with the rail companies, of course, after he squashed their impending strike, to ensure that he could secure the, you know, paid time off for them was also great. But I think that his unwillingness to value the lives of, you know, Palestinians who have nowhere to go, nowhere to flee to, who have been absolutely tortured over the last 6 months, that to me shows a lack of moral character that I just cannot support. And I think a lot of Democratic voters and independents who lean Democratic have just decided, listen, I get that Trump is bad, but how are you going to argue that Biden is the decent one,
right,
when he is the one greenlighting the slaughter of literal women and children who have done nothing wrong in Gaza? He is supplying the 2,000-pound bombs. You know, while he nickel and dimes the American people, while we keep hearing over and over again that we don't have the resources for more robust social safety net programs, he seems to really engage in no debate in regard to weapons transfers to the tune of billions of dollars. I mean, just this week, a weapons transfer worth $2.5 billion. Israel is the top recipient of military aid and foreign aid from the United States, regardless of what they do. And I think a lot of Americans are waking up to this. It's not just Democrats. You're also seeing now a sizable portion of Republican voters who are like, hey, wait a minute. We actually do believe in America first. And while we're also not in favor of, you know, funding Ukraine for their self-defense, we also don't want to fund Israel's war on Gaza. And so I think there's some area for the left and the right to potentially work together to apply pressure on politicians to at least reject AIPAC, to at least do something that changes the paradigm of the U.S. relations to Israel. But overall, when I look at the growing percentage of Democratic voters who have turned their backs on Biden, I don't blame them. And in fact, I'm definitely one of them.
So, Anna, have you decided you're not voting for him in the fall? Or what do you think? How are you thinking about that?
I will not vote for Joe Biden under any circumstance, even if he were to end the war right now. I think what he has demonstrated over the last 6 months has been absolutely deplorable, unacceptable, and I could never support it. That doesn't mean I support Trump, but I would never cast a ballot for Joe Biden.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very much in the same place. And it's Kyle actually went in a private conversation, said they basically have us checkmated, because I think still, even now, like when election night comes, it's not like if Trump were to win, like I would find that horrifying. And I do think, especially if you look at domestic policy, like it's very clear Biden is way better on labor rights, way better on antitrust, you know, did a few good things. But there's just a red moral line when it comes to funding a genocide over months and months and months. And so I feel just as you do that, like, even if he did a 180 now today, it's too late. It's too late.
Mm-hmm. And about 50% of the people who they talked to in Michigan who voted uncommitted, about 50% of them were like, he's already gone too far. That's it. I'm out. And they'll either sit out or vote for a third party candidate. But the other 50% were saying, like, yeah, if he changes it, turns it around, changes the policy, then maybe I'll vote for him. And I think this is a really difficult, like, philosophical question. I'm where you are, Anna, and I'm where you are, Crystal, on this. But what I'm curious about is how I'm going to feel on election night when the results start rolling in. Because I'm like, basically, the stuff said by like the most cringe resistance liberal imaginable about Trump, I think they're right. I think he's a threat to democracy. He says stuff like, you know, we need to terminate the Constitution or suspend the Constitution. So, and you pair that with his policy record, which was abysmal. It's just George W. Bush on steroids and warmongering. I always find it funny when people say he was anti-war. He was not even close to anti-war. It's a ridiculous thing to say.
Yeah.
So, like, but I wonder how I'm going to feel on election night, because I agree. I'm not going to go cast a vote for somebody who's in the midst of arming and aiding and abetting a genocide. I think that's crazy. I think there are some clear moral red lines, but I'm also not going to judge people who do decide to do that, because if you look at it sort of like almost like a math problem, right? Like, let's just calculate this quantitatively. Who's done better? Then it's like with Biden, and we've made the argument a million times. You got the student loan debt reduction, the $1,400 stimulus checks. He massively reduced the drone war. He pulled out of Afghanistan. He, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act had some good stuff in it. You guys brought up the NLRB. He's added 800,000 manufacturing jobs. You got the CHIPS Act. You got a bunch of stuff that we could point to that's a 15% corporate minimum tax rate, which I think is a big deal. Like, all that is good, and I'm not taking anything away from that at all. But that's why I'm saying my own, like, philosophical confusion over this. I'm curious how I'll feel on election night when the results start coming in. If it's like, it looks like Trump's going to win, I'll probably feel like fucking shit. But if it's like Biden looks like he's going to hold on, I don't know how I'll feel. Will I be like, yeah, fuck this guy too? Or will it be like, just like almost like a neutral, indifferent type feeling? I'm curious. How do you think you're going to feel on election day? I know it's a hard question to ask because we don't know until we're there.
I don't think I'm going to feel anything. Regardless of who wins. That's how much I dislike both candidates. And look, you just rattled off a list of good things that Biden did. But again, to me, those are the types of programs that progressives have been fighting for. And remember, we haven't even really gotten the actual programs we've been fighting for. We've gotten a tiny, tiny percentage. He's barely scratched the surface with some of those programs that he managed to accomplish. I mean, you look at the Inflation Reduction Act, and Democrats love to brag about how, Medicare is going to be able to negotiate 10 pharmaceutical drug prices. Right. By the time we hit 2026, which is when they'll be able to do so, or when the new prices would come into effect, a lot of those drugs that are on that list will have generic options available. They'll be more affordable. So there are all sorts of caveats to the good things that Biden has done. And I agree with you that I don't think it's right to vote shame anyone, right? I don't agree with going after Democratic voters who are genuinely terrified of Trump and feel that regardless of what Biden has done with Gaza, they're going to cast a ballot for him. Great. You do what makes you comfortable because this is a democracy and we shouldn't shame people for how they vote. But the other thing that I'll say is, you know, the Democratic Party insisting on Biden being the one to run against Trump has actually had a pretty big psychological impact on me. And that psychological impact has been basically the dismantling of fear within me because I don't believe them anymore. I don't believe that they're genuinely afraid that Trump is going to dismantle our democracy. Because if they really thought that, they would want to have a robust primary to ensure that they have the best possible Democratic candidate to go up against Trump. And they just don't. They don't. And they don't seem to really care about the fact that they don't. They keep trying to gaslight Democratic voters into thinking Biden is the best, you know, potential candidate to run up against Trump. But they know that's not true. They know that's not true. I mean, they're constantly hiding Biden. It's unclear whether Biden's going to have a single debate with Trump for the general election. I mean, it's totally pathetic. So I could be naive, but I really do think that it's the behavior of the Democratic Party that's had this psychological impact on me.
So what would you say, to play devil's advocate, to that, you know, PodSave bro or his listeners who says, all right, but let's get serious. You got two options. This is kind of the Hillary Clinton case she was making the other day.
Get over yourself.
You got two options, realistically. And, you know, also the you could end up with Trump getting another Supreme Court pick with another term in office. And we've seen the damage that they've been able to do. You've got abortion rights on the ballot. You've got also, you know, a genuine threat to democracy. We saw what happened on January 6th. We saw the chaos that he, you know, that he fomented with all of that nonsense. You do, you know, have some progress from Biden on things, issues that we care about, and worker power in particular, for me being one of the most important ones. So when you've got these two, this binary choice, why would you throw your vote away? Why would you give Trump the upper hand in that, since you're, you know, taking away from Biden and, you know, not supporting him?
Genocide. That's the answer. Go ahead.
I mean, yeah. I mean, Kyle, you just hit the nail on the head before I could even say a word. 1.5 million Americans slaughtered by Turks in 1915 during
Armenians,
World War
I. Yes,
absolutely slaughtered by Turks. And I come from those people. My ancestors suffered that. For me to then cast a ballot for a guy who is greenlighting the genocide of Palestinian people, I'm sorry. I can't. I personally cannot do it. And while, again, yes, Biden on a domestic level accomplished a few good things, people are going to hate that I'm saying this, but it's true. On a personal level, I have not seen an improvement in my life, okay, at all under Biden. And so, yes, again, there are good things, but not good enough to overwhelm the absolute rage I feel within me every day as I produce and talk about stories regarding Biden's support for Israel's annihilation of the Palestinian people in Gaza. And by the way, the West Bank, I mean, because of the conditions on the ground in Gaza, that gets most of the attention. But innocent people who are being absolutely brutalized by settlers in the West Bank, unacceptable. And I don't know if you guys saw the story, but the Biden administration quietly reversed the weak-ass sanctions that they had implemented against, you know, a few settlers.
Yeah, it was
like four people.
They
even reversed that.
Yeah. Pathetic.
So sad.
Well, it's important you bring up the West Bank because it's part of the picture, because that's part of what paints the picture of this overall annihilation, that at the same time you have what's happening in Gaza, you have an aggressive attempt to further push Palestinians off of their land. I mean, it all fits together very closely with the end goal of, you know, the Netanyahu government, and certainly the most psycho of the psycho members of the Netanyahu government.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is where I'm at, and I don't want anyone to feel that they have to vote the same way I do, or that I'm trying to encourage people to vote the same way I'm going to vote. I think voting is important. I'll probably write a candidate in, but you know, and I will obviously vote down ballot for my preferred candidates and my preferred issues. Voting is important, but what's even more important than voting, I believe, is to get involved and to build something from the grassroots that could actually appropriately and effectively apply pressure from the outside toward the Democratic Party. Right now, the Republican Party has that with MAGA, with the America First crowd. They're loud. They're, you know, I don't know if they're professionally organized. I don't know if they're organized in any way, shape, or form. But because of the fact that Trump has this, you know, base of support that's so aggressive, the Republican politicians who previously were not interested in Trump at all and certainly like looked down their noses at Trump took him seriously, continue to take him seriously. And it's because they're afraid of the people, not of Trump himself, right? And I think our strategy of simply electing people who ran as progressives has failed for the most part. And it's because we don't have a successful pressure campaign that's organized on the outside.
So I want to switch gears in just a second here and ask you about Ben Shapiro and Candace Owens. But I wanted to comment on, you made the point about the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
I think there's like, I don't think there's anything wrong with looking at the Pod Save Bros and say, yeah, on the Supreme Court thing, good point. Like, you're right. I agree. Like, I'd rather have Biden pick than Trump. There's nothing wrong with saying that. But again, obviously the ultimate rebuttal is always going to be, don't put the onus on me if he's the one that's doing the genocide. Like, you should be yelling at him to stop doing the genocide. And then the Supreme Court point would be an actual like debate ender and a mind changer, as opposed to like, yeah, you're right, but genocide is a thing that's happening. You know what I'm saying?
Well, in fairness to the Pod Save Bros, even they have broken with Biden over his,
I've seen they're going in on Israel
policy, which is, I mean, that's again what makes this moment astonishing. Because if you look at the polling, obviously Democratic base wildly disagrees. Apparently his own wife disagrees. You've lost the Pod Save Bros. I actually wanted to get
them is wild.
It is wild.
Wild.
Barak Ravid, who served in the IDF, who is one of the administration's go-to reporters with regard to Israel, he's been making some extremely, you know, strident, very pointed comments about the way Israel has conducted this war. I did wonder if you could reflect a little bit, Anna, on you were making the comment earlier about how in Joe Biden's eyes, Palestinians just, it's like they don't exist. They don't have full humanity for him. And there was even a interview with Aaron David Miller, who's a very well-respected foreign policy head in D.C., who admitted as much. And yet this week, because you had Jose Andres, who, you know, Biden personally and many other Biden administration officials know, who was directly impacted, it almost seemed like the first time Palestinian humanity or any sort of humanity in Gaza really existed for some prominent liberals, although Biden has continued to maintain, you know, yes, he's angry, but nothing will change.
I did notice that there was an increased level of criticism toward Israel after, you know, these international aid workers were killed. But I've also noticed that there's been an increasing trend of people who started off by supporting Israel and continued supporting Israel, even way late in the game, if you ask me.
Yeah.
But it gets to a point where you can't deny what we're all seeing. Like, we're all seeing the videos.
Yeah.
We're all seeing the very specific stories of children who were killed in awful, awful ways. I can't help but think of the little six-year-old girl who was trapped in a car that suffered an airstrike from the IDF. All of her family members are dead in that car. She's trapped in it. And, you know, the IDF decides to do a strike against the ambulance that shows up to save her. I mean, these stories, I don't know about you guys, but there are very specific stories and specific images that haunt me at night when I'm trying to go to sleep. There is an image of a little girl, a baby. She was in a giant tent. She had died. Okay. She's just wrapped up alone in this giant white tent in Gaza. And no one came to claim her body because every single one of her family members was killed. And I'm not a mother, but I can totally understand how that could be a mother's absolute worst nightmare, okay? For your little girl to die alone and for no one to be there to claim your little girl's body. The stories about the graves that were dug up by the IDF and how those, you know, Palestinian remains were then put in a mass grave because it was impossible to identify the corpses. It's just, I can't support Biden after this. I can't, because these are the images, these are the stories that haunt me every single day. And for anyone who comes at me and says, well, you know, you should be ashamed of yourself because Biden had a great NLRB. I hear you, but his disregard for human lives, again, shows me a lack of moral character that goes so far that I just can't support him. That's just where I'm at.
I feel the same way.
History will judge very harshly. This will be looked at like the Armenian genocide, the Holocaust, et cetera.
The starvation is the thing that really haunts me, maybe more than anything. It's like literally every time I sit down to eat. And, you know, as a human being, as a mother, as, you know, someone who's watching this unfold, like imagining not being able to feed your child and just watching them wither away, having to hear them cry at night of hunger. It's so hard for me to imagine how someone who has the power to end this doesn't. Like, I honestly had plenty of criticisms for Joe Biden. I had no illusions about who this man was going in, and I never could have imagined this. Never could have.
Yep.
Same.
All right, so let's switch gears here. So I'm curious your thoughts on the whole Ben Shapiro, Candace Owens thing. I know you have debated Ben in the past. You know Ben, so that might give you maybe a little bit of a different perspective from somebody like me who sort of mocks on him and shits on him regularly. just to catch everybody up on the gist of it. So Candace Owens, I mean, she was defending Kanye West back when he was having his outright Nazi meltdown. When he, you know,
and still is,
he
up
said,
to today.
I'm going DEFCON 3 on the Jews or whatever he said. And Candace was like, well, do we really know what he means? Like, then, you know, Candace also had that very famous thing that she said about, like, well, you know, Hitler, if he was just trying to make Germany great, that's fine. The problem is that he was like a globalist and he went outside of his borders. It's like, I don't think that's the problem with Hitler. I don't think that's it. But so back then, though, she would say those things. And you'd barely get a peep out of Ben Shapiro. And it would be like, yeah, she's a host on the Daily Wire, free speech. What are we going to do? Like, hands off, let's go here. But then now, recently, she's become more and more vocal. She brought on a rabbi to debate the rabbi. The rabbi accused her of anti-Semitism. She's had a beef with Rabbi Shmuley. But at this point, honestly, who hasn't had a beef with Rabbi Shmuley? Rabbi Shmuley's the most annoying man on the planet. And then now it seems like there was a falling out. We don't really know if she was fired or she left or it was mutual. But Jeremy Boring announced, like, you know, we've ended our relationship, or however he phrased it. What do you make of that? Do you look at that and say, hey, man, even if Candace was being anti-Semitic, you guys, when you hear some racist shit, you say free speech. So why would it be any different in this scenario? You should still give her a platform. Or do you look at that and you say, yeah, there are some things outside the Overton window and they should be outside the Overton window. So, you know, Ben has every right to do that and should do that.
I actually have some interesting insight on this because I watch some conservative content creators who are very small in terms of their audience, and a lot of people don't know about them. But they're regular people, and they just express what they genuinely think. And it helps me to have a better idea of what trends are emerging within the conservatives, within the Republican Party. And one thing that was really fascinating to me is, there's a lot of backlash toward Ben Shapiro for firing her, even though I agree. I mean, she has absolutely said some pretty gross and anti-Semitic things in the past. I wish that she just focused on criticizing the Israeli government, because she did have some moments of clarity where she had criticism for the government of Israel that I agree with. And I think she could have been an effective communicator if she focused on that. But I guess her anti-Semitism got in the way. And I don't begrudge Shapiro for just not being in favor of that and not wanting that at a media outlet that he co-founded, right? So I understand where he's coming from, and I don't begrudge him for the decision he made at all. However, the fact that he made that decision, and let's keep it real, she was fired. Her last show on the Daily Wire, she signed off by saying, I'll see you tomorrow. So she was under the assumption that she would be back tomorrow to do another show. And then all of a sudden she's gone. But in regard to what I'm hearing from conservative content creators who, you know, watch the Daily Wire, you know, there's a growing number of people of color who are now identifying as conservative. And now they're looking at the Daily Wire and they're like, wait a minute. You didn't have a problem with Candace Owens saying some pretty terrible things about Black people, brown people, Muslims, yada, yada. You get the point. But the second she said things you didn't like about Israel, you get rid of her, right? All of a sudden, your free speech absolutism doesn't matter. It just falls by the wayside because you're so offended. And so they see it as, oh, Ben values Israelis more than Americans and is totally fine with hosts saying terrible things about Americans who might be, you know, politically minded in a way that they don't like, but nonetheless, there's still various minority groups that, you know, hosts say terrible things about, and that's totally fine. It's totally above board. But once Candace criticizes the government of Israel, you get rid of her.
Right.
And that's the way that they see it, you know?
Well, that's the way I see it too. Because, I mean, yeah, the things she said about Hitler, no problem. The things she said about Kanye, no problem. But then it's when she's critical of Israel, that's when suddenly she's fired. Because you're right. If he had a blanket across the board, non-discrimination, you can't say racist things about anybody, and this was applied consistently, and it was applied to Candace, you know, as and when it occurred, that's one thing. But it does sort of speak to this weird dynamic on the right where sort of like blatant anti-Semitism of the type that, you know, Trump has also trafficked in at times is fine as long as it isn't directed at the state of Israel, because then you also come in contact with actually the biggest supporters of the Netanyahu government as a demographic group in this country right now are not Jewish Americans. It's white evangelical Christians.
Yes.
Who, of course, make up, you know, the most lockstep support for Trump and a key and very influential part of the Republican base. So I think that's why you get this sort of weirdness where flirtation with out and out Nazis, you know, blatant anti-Semitic rhetoric, that's all right. But the moment you have a critique of the actual Israeli government, that's where we draw the line. And the other piece with Shapiro that I think is a big problem for him is, you know, his platform. Part of why it's so successful and why he's so wealthy is because his positioning as this like free speech warrior. And so that's fine if you're not that. But, you know, don't tell me about the Overton window when it comes to your platform, but then have a critique of the New York Times when there's a backlash over the Tom Cotton op-ed calling for, you know, military response to crush protesters. Like if you're a publisher and you've got your Overton window and you're allowed to do whatever you want, then you don't really have a voice. You don't have a say when it comes to New York Times or NBC firing Ronna McDaniel or whatever other free speech controversy you want to bring up that he was on, you know, the quote unquote free speech side of.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, you should remain consistent, especially if you've been making this argument about the value of free speech for so, so long. But again, at the same time, it's just so fascinating that all of the, I mean, Candace Owens, some of her worst anti-Semitic statements weren't even from this year. Like that's right. The thing that's so mind-blowing about all of it, right? Yeah. So, look, I really do think there are a few exceptions, I think. I do think that there are a few people who so far have been consistent in their free speech absolutism. However, I think most people who claim that they value free speech are full of it because the second the speech touches a sensitive, you know, a sensitive issue for them, all of a sudden, no, we want to silence them, you know?
Yeah.
But that's Elon Musk syndrome.
Or Dakota that passed that, like, you know, here's the things that are anti-Semitism law. And it was like basically criticizing Israel.
There was like 12 things on the list.
Yeah. And Florida was doing so. Texas was doing some stuff, too.
Well, anti-BDS laws, too. Those are all.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I know. The BDS laws, absolutely. How are they constitutional? How are
so
those?
They're actually not. They get slapped down when they go through the court system. They get slapped down pretty quickly. I know Abby Martin went to court over. She was going to give a speech at some university
in Georgia.
They were like, you got to sign this thing saying you won't criticize Israel. And she's like, no. And then she took him to court and won. Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy.
But, so I wanted to switch gears again here. So one of the things I'm really curious about, and I watch you and Cenk a decent amount, I'd say. What issues do you feel like you and Cenk disagree on the most these days?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, as I said earlier, I have kind of shed a lot of the fear that if Trump gets reelected, he's going to dismantle democracy. And it's not because I trust that Trump wouldn't try to dismantle democracy. I just think that our government and our institutions are more robust than the Democratic Party would have you believe. And I don't think he would be able to accomplish what Democrats are alleging he'd be able to accomplish. I also think, by the way, let me give you another thing that Democrats fear-mongered about and never came to fruition. Democrats alleged that, you know, Louis DeJoy, the postmaster general, was going to help Trump steal the election in 2020, that he was such a threat because it's an election year where there's going to be a ton of mail-in ballots. So this is disastrous, right? Louis DeJoy is a threat to American democracy. Well, it turns out that he wasn't. Okay, Biden wins, and he remains the postmaster general. So I don't, like, it's hard for me to buy into some of the fear-mongering that I hear from Democrats. Cenk, I think, disagrees with me the most on this issue. I mean, we haven't really talked about it as much on the show. I think we will as we get closer to the general election. But Cenk is definitely more concerned about Trump dismantling our democracy than I am at this point. So, and I could be totally naive. I do acknowledge that.
So is his perspective that as we get closer to the election, because he said a million times, my number one thing is making sure Trump doesn't get back in there. And that's even why he ran, which we can talk about that in a little bit. But so you think as
Let's
you guys
not.
Get close.
Tell so, us how you really feel, Anna.
So you think as you get closer to the election, he'll, you know, start ramping up the commentary and the rhetoric, talking about how, like, hey, man, they did the fake elector scheme. They did the, fraudulent elector scheme, which they said in their own words. They tried 14 different ways to steal the election. But we were just lucky that we had somebody like Bill Barr, of all people, who was at the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. Who's like, I'm not fucking doing that. Right. They tried. There were memos about, like, let's declare martial law. And you needed, like, the adults in the room to step in and be like, we're just not doing that. Like, stop bringing that up. Now it looks like Trump does kind of want to pack his administration with complete and utter sycophants and loyalists. He already did that at the RNC. He put Laura Trump in over there as like the number two in command. And then there was a bloodbath where they fired 60 different people. And so do you think those fears aren't warranted, or is it like a different point of contention with you and Cenk?
I think those fears are warranted. I just don't think that Trump is going to succeed. Look, I get that our current Supreme Court is devastatingly conservative, but they have ruled against Trump many times, right? So which gives me a little bit of hope, because I have no doubt that if he somehow manages to steal the election, it's going to get challenged. It's going to get challenged in the courts. I don't think the Supreme Court would side with him if there's overwhelming evidence that he didn't in fact win and instead had implemented some scheme to steal the election. But remember, after the whole fake electors plot, Congress passed legislation essentially making it abundantly clear that you can't install, you know, your own electors, and the electors that we do have must carry out the wishes of the voters in the state, right? And so there are more robust laws in place. And again, I could totally be naive and I could totally be wrong, but the thing that would actually light a fire under my ass is if the Democratic Party actually acted like Donald Trump is a threat to our democracy. You know, the fact that they didn't even pursue prosecution against his attempt to steal the election until fairly recently, pretty late in the game, that communicates something to me. You know, it's just, did you guys really feel that he was a threat to our democracy? Do you genuinely feel he's a threat to our democracy? Because they certainly haven't acted like it. And anytime the issue comes up, it's always something that's discussed in the context of, you know, political ambitions, or, you know, the issue is used for political purposes rather than in a way that communicates to me that the Democratic Party is genuinely concerned about maintaining and protecting our democratic process.
What do you make of some of the comments Trump has made with regards to Israel and what you think, you know, how you think he would have handled what's unfolding right now and what it would look
awful
like under his administration?
I've
got some new ones for you that I just saw today that I can read. This was an interview apparently with Hugh Hewitt. I know we're all a big fan of his. Anyway, he says, question, are you still standing with Israel 100%? You achieved the Abraham Accords, which was the first peace deal since Sadat. Okay. Donald Trump says, right. And Hugh Hewitt says, and so are you still 100% with Israel? What's your advice to Netanyahu beyond get it over with in a hurry? Trump says, well, that's all the advice you can give. I mean, that's the advice. You've got to get it over with and you have to get back to normalcy. And I'm not sure that I'm loving the way they're doing it because you've got to have victory. You have to have a victory and it's taking a long time. And the other thing I hate, they put out tapes all the time, every night. They're releasing tapes of a building falling down. They shouldn't be releasing tapes like that. They're doing, that's why they're losing the PR war. They, Israel, is absolutely losing the PR war. And he goes on to continue to talk more about how they're losing the PR war. So he made some previous comments, I'm sure you saw, you probably covered on your show as well, where he was saying similar things, like they got to get it over with and they got to get to peace. A lot of people interpreted that in a lot of different ways. What do you kind of make of the way that Trump is talking about the issue?
Well, Trump talks in a way where his statements can be interpreted in different ways, right? Mm-hmm. And so yeah. I don't put much weight behind his statements, but just judging on how he behaved during his first term toward Israel, I am under, you know, no delusions that Trump would be better than Biden on this issue. I'm just not.
Do you think it could be worse? Is it possible for it to be worse than it is?
How much... I don't know how much more worse it could get.
I know. It's, I feel
it's
the same
so
way.
It would just, so he just wouldn't do the finger wagging, the like, angry Biden had a serious conversation with Netanyahu. It would just be, he just wouldn't say, it's like when they chopped up Khashoggi, Saudi Arabia chopped up Jamal Khashoggi, and Trump just didn't say shit about it. It was just like, that happened. Saudi Arabia chops people up. Like, what are you going to do about it? Here, give him more weapons. With Biden, you have the hypocrisy angle of, I'm against this. Here's more money and weapons. With Trump, it'll just be, I'm not going to say I'm against it. I'm just going to keep sending you the money and the weapons, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Trump was even worse than that when it came to Khashoggi. Remember, Trump tried to deny it at first and provide cover for the Saudi.
That's right.
And so, look, again, and Kyle, you're one of the few people who luckily will straighten out the record in regard to Trump's hawkishness, because I can't stand when people are like, oh yeah, Trump is like the peacemaker, no wars under Trump. We came very close to a war with Iran under Trump. So no, he is not some peacenik. That's a complete and utter joke. I think the one area in which Trump might be better than Biden when it comes to Israel is that, you know, Biden looks pathetic and weak, and he looks like he's selling out the American people on behalf of Israel. And I know that Trump cares a lot more about appearing strong, about appearing as like the strong man on the international stage. So I think that the backlash that's coming from critics of Israel's far-right government and even the America First crowd might persuade him to handle the situation differently. But I wouldn't put money behind that. I have no idea. And I wouldn't say that Trump would be better than Biden.
Well, there's a couple things that I've been thinking about with this. Number one, he does have this like classic Trump petty, bitchy grievance against Netanyahu, which is that Bibi acknowledged that Biden won the election. And he's like never forgiven him for that, apparently. So you'll recall right after October 7th, Trump came out and said some critical things of Bibi.
Teeny little criticism. And
then everybody freaked out and he, you know, walked it back and got, you know, to the place that he was supposed to be. So there's that. I will say, I think that Biden, as I said before, has this genuine, fervent, locked in ideological view towards Israel that's basically unshakable. I think Trump does not have that. I think his view is purely transactional, as it is, you know, with most things. It's just that in Republican Party politics, the math of that transaction always adds up to do whatever Israel wants you to do.
And he took $100 million from Sheldon Adelson on two separate occasions.
Yeah.
And that actually is probably the main reason why he said, I'm going to green light moving the embassy to Jerusalem, which also, by the way, was a massive middle finger to Palestinians and the Abraham Accords. People don't talk about this. People on the right bring it up like it's some sort of accomplishment. The whole point of the Abraham Accords was to give a giant middle finger to Palestinians to say, we're going to work around you and pretend like you don't exist.
Right.
And that could have sparked Hamas to be like, well, all right, we're here, bitch.
Hamas has said that was part of their. Now, Biden, of course, continued the Abraham Accords.
Of course.
But the other thing from that interview that, you know, caught a lot of attention where he said, oh, you have to get the job done and you have to get to peace, was he got asked about this crazy plan from his former ambassador for Israel to just unilaterally assert their claim of sovereignty over the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, quote unquote. And he's like, oh, I'll look into it. And that was last time around. Like he also said in that interview, because he, you know, he did something similar with the Golan Heights last time around, again, in line with him giving them whatever they wanted when he was in office. And he even said in this interview, like, oh, I didn't really know anything about it. And I asked him, you know, give me a five minute history lesson. And after that, I was like, sure. Okay. So that's the man we're dealing with, where if you make the case to him in a 5 minute history lesson that makes some kind of transactional sense to him, he'll just, you know, give away the West Bank, and that's that.
Yeah. I was going to bring up the Adelson money as well.
Yeah.
And you're right. Trump is purely transactional, and all the transactions point in the, you know, direction of favoring Israel over the Palestinian people. So it just sucks that we have two candidates who were awful already without the Israel situation, but then you have pretty much complete agreement on supporting Israel, regardless of what they do to the Palestinian people, which is why, you know, despite what some members of our audience and some on the left might argue, because I've been so critical about Biden and I've been pretty critical of the left recently, I have no interest in supporting Trump. He doesn't at all represent my politics or the direction I want to see this country go in.
And RFK Jr.'s.
Oh, God.
Perhaps the worst of them all. It's like,
what
a bunch of choices we've got.
Do you remember when Trump said he viewed Mahmoud Abbas as a father?
No.
Remember that?
Yes.
No.
You don't remember that? He was like, you know, Bibi, I don't think he wants peace. He was saying
I remember that part.
And then
he
goes, you know, Abbas, really sweet guy. I look at him like a father.
It's so crazy.
It's amazing.
It's weird because
he's so funny.
I know.
It's not really fair.
It's not fair.
He is funny and it's not fair. You're right.
So bottom line, Anna, you're going to be writing in Cenk this fall. Is that the plan?
I'm going to be writing someone in. Yeah. Look, I love Cenk. Right. I think it was pretty clear that I wasn't on board with his presidential run, but I love
literally
him.
Just from like facial expressions. Like it was just,
you know, it was just
from like body language. It's like, oh, you don't like
this. I thought you handled that, the initial interview with him. I wanted to give you credit. I thought you handled it very well, because I'm sure that was a difficult position for you to be in and trying to be neutral, try to ask the questions that people would want and all. I thought you handled it very, very well. And, you know, and also brought your own personal concerns to the table. And also to his credit, like he clearly was willing to field all of those and air that all out. So I thought you guys both handled that very well and deserve some kudos for it.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I remember, you know, after that interview, because I was very, my biggest issue with it was, okay, well, you're going to keep co-hosting the show. And I just feel like, I don't feel good about that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so he had even less editorial say in the show during his presidential run. And so when we did that interview, obviously, like I didn't give him questions ahead of time. He had no idea what I was going to ask. And then after the interview, he's like, that was definitely the toughest interview I've had so far in regard to, you know, running. Well, he announced it on the show. And then weeks later, after he had done a bunch of interviews, he said that. And I was like, well, yeah, I mean, you asked me to interview you when I was mad that you were doing this. So you're going to get tough questions.
Yeah. Well, he hinted at it for the first time, actually, with us.
Yeah.
Yes.
And when he first said it, Sagar and I both just let it go because we didn't think he really meant it. And then he brought it up again. And I was like, oh, wait, you're actually serious about this. Listen, obviously it didn't work out the way that he wanted, but I can never dismiss someone who puts themselves out there in that way, because I know it's very difficult. Right. And I thought he was like self-deprecating about the results and made some really important points, both about, you know, the problems with Biden and also then about, you know, the need for a ceasefire and really pushing that, and about how, listen, naturalized citizens should have the same rights as natural born citizens. So I thought it was important that he raised that issue as well.
Yeah, that was the part that I actually really did like, right? The fact that he was going to challenge the whole naturalized citizen thing all the way to the Supreme Court if he could. And he definitely tried, and it came at an, you know, it came at a giant cost to him both personally and financially. And I'm just tired of Cenk doing that. I want Cenk to really like lean into his power where he has it. And I think it's the platform that he's built. It's the, you know, voice that he has built, not just with TYT, but I think among the left. And I'm just tired of people constantly trashing him. I'm tired of the Democratic establishment crushing anyone who dare challenge them. Mm-hmm. And so I was expecting a lot of dirty games because the Democratic Party did play a lot of dirty games when Cenk was running for Congress. Mm-hmm. Luckily, they didn't do that this time around because they just didn't allow for an actual primary to take place. But, yeah, you know, right. I give him credit. He does these things not for himself, but because he genuinely thinks that maybe this is a way of affecting change in a positive direction. And he'll do it knowing that there will be a huge cost to himself. I'm just at a point in my life where I'm let's relax with huge costs to ourselves and let's try to find a better way of building power outside of these institutions to apply pressure to get the policies that we want.
I think he struggled to realize that our biggest enemy is actually indifference. And he was treated with complete and utter indifference. It wasn't even like contempt. It wasn't even like, here, we're going to write 78 smear pieces on you. Because at least if somebody's writing smear pieces on you, it has the potential to spark a backlash where some people were like, that's not fucking fair. And I'm actually with this guy now. He was just treated with utter indifference. And I feel like Mariana was a very, very similar thing. Mm-hmm. And that's why, like, if they don't acknowledge you exist, then nobody even knows that there's people running against Biden and then nothing comes about from it. So it's a total like across the board media blackout, political blackout. And I feel like that's the biggest thing that the left runs up against when running for a big office, whether it be the Senate or the presidency. And that's why I've said now, I'm really of the belief that in order for an actual lefty to win the White House, it would either have to be somebody who was like a senator like Bernie Sanders, who came very, very close. Mm-hmm. It's undeniable. If you're a senator, you're undeniable. They're going to take you seriously, regardless of what you believe. Or the other thing is some A-list celebrity. Maybe we can go as low as a B-list, but that's why, you know, I know Cenk, I think he agrees with me on this. Somebody like if Jon Stewart ran for president in 2028, they would be all over that because they can't keep the cameras off him. He's an A-list celebrity, so he's undeniable. He's funny, so that's going to generate news stories.
Yeah.
But somebody like me or Cenk or any of us, they'll just be like, we don't even know your name. We don't even fuck off. We don't even know who you are. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And, you know, I have some critiques of some of the positions that Jon Stewart has, but I'm also in agreement with Cenk. If Jon Stewart ran, I do think that it would be a lot more difficult for Biden to ignore him. But unfortunately, Stewart wasn't willing to run.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was incredible to watch how they just were able to shut that whole process down. It was also kind of funny to watch Dean Phillips come to some terms with like, oh my God, these people are evil. Like realizing the sort of tricks that they play. Cause he thought, oh, I'm a member of Congress. Of course they're going to take me seriously. And then they're like, nope, sorry.
I mean, not only that, he's very much a team player in the Democratic establishment.
Yep.
Yeah. He had 100% Biden voting record.
Exactly. And it's just, it is amazing how different figures in the Democratic Party openly talk about how they view like paying your dues and waiting your turn. Mm-hmm. It's almost like the Democratic Party has like, you know, election year by election year, what's going to happen and who's allowed to run. It's pathetic and it's sick. But I will say that obvious like scheming that's taking place behind the scenes dissuaded Newsom from running.
Yes.
And I'm very happy about that. Okay.
Really?
Newsom, oh, she despises Newsom even more than you do.
Yeah, so wait, I mean, I also hate Gavin Newsom, but I probably would take him over Joe Biden. But not
she,
you.
She lives in California.
Yeah,
she,
I know. You actually have to like deal with the consequences of his policies. No. So you would take Biden over Newsom.
Newsom's awful in so many different ways. You know, I did a lengthy deep dive into his bailouts for PG&E, which sparked multiple devastating fires, but the 2018 Camp Fire was the worst.
Right.
And there are still homeowners who lost everything as a result of PG&E refusing to replace a $10 hook which, you know, it had basically eroded to the to the point where the power lines fell on dry brush, and that's what sparked the fire. It was just a $10 hook that they needed to replace, but they care about their profits so much that they just refuse to upgrade their equipment. And at the end of the day, Newsom ensured that they were made whole, and there are still, you know, people in California who lost their homes. They weren't made whole. In fact, they're living in tents or in RVs on their property. Their homes are gone. Jesus. It's disgusting. He's disgusting. He's a terrible, terrible person. I would never support Gavin Newsom. In fact, I might even consider voting for Republican before I voted for Gavin Newsom. Wow. That's how much I hate him.
Wow. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I interviewed Sean O'Brien, who's the president of the Teamsters. And the Teamsters and unions in general really backed Newsom heavily for his recall election. And then Newsom turned around because he's, you know, it's so important to him, the Silicon Valley money and the Hollywood money. And screwed them when it came to autonomous, you know, trucks. Mack trucks on the road. Mm-hmm. And man, Sean O'Brien had some choice words for him as well. He said like there's just no loyalty with him, and he's completely in the pocket of big tech. That's his whole thing.
He's a slippery little fucker. Like, that's just who he is. You know, that's just who he is. And I'm glad that Sean O'Brien had that experience, because now that he's been burned by Newsom, hopefully he learns to not support him or endorse him, because Newsom is going to run for president eventually. I have no doubt about that.
Definitely.
He's very ambitious. Yeah.
He won't have at least some corners of labor on his side for sure.
So I want to ask you, let's talk about your take on Trump voters, because I feel like you and I have almost had like total polar opposite reactions. So I would say back in 2015, 2016, to the extent that I got shit, it was from people saying I'm like too kind to them. If you remember back then, there was a big debate. You had one side of the argument, like the Mehdi Hasan type argument is like, it's just racism and xenophobia and bigotry. And that's why they are how they are. And that's the like determinative factor.
Right.
And the argument that I would make back then is like, that's just not true. If you listen to him on the campaign trail, there's a lot of stuff he says about, I'm going to protect Social Security. I'm going to protect Medicare. Your job was outsourced under Democrats. I'm going to protect your job. It's not going to be outsourced under me. And I was very sympathetic to the idea that at least some percentage of the Trump people, it was driven about by economic anxiety. I hate that term, but we'll use it here. Economic anxiety to one extent or another. And so I could see how, and there were, I think there were like 9 million people who voted for Obama two times and then voted for Donald Trump in 2016. And I would look at that and say, you can't just say those people are racist. That's just, you're being glib. You're not like, you're not steel manning them. You're straw manning them. And it's not fair. Right. And I probably maintained that until about maybe 2020 ish. And then around 2020 and moving forward to today, the point that I'm out at now is I still think what I said back then is true. I think it's true in that time and place. But when I look at the people who are still riding hard for Trump now, I mean, I know it sounds harsh, but I see it's very, very cultish to me. The way that it's like, they don't think about his policy record. They don't even think about his rhetoric. To me, it looks like these people are driven by like feelings and emotions. And it's almost like, I hate the people that Trump hates. And the people that hate Trump are like the big bad guys in the country. And so I hate them. It's almost like this like idol worship type thing. And so it's like, I was more sympathetic back then. And then now I have like zero patience and I'm like, this is fucking stupid. Fuck these people. And I feel like, I feel like you've gone a little bit the other way, where back then you were probably more critical of them than I was. And then now you're starting to see like, well, let's not straw man them. Let's try to take the best version of their argument and take it at face value and then react to it. Is that how you see it? Like, tell me where I'm wrong in this breakdown.
Well, it's so interesting that you say that, because I was literally thinking about that last night. I was thinking about a tweet that you had put out, I don't know, several years ago.
Don't ever think about tweets I put out years ago. Don't ever do that. Nobody should ever be doing that.
But I was thinking about it because it's hilarious. Like, look, you and I had some issues, right? Which I'm totally over. Obviously, like, we're cool. It's fine. But in the middle of that, you had tweeted something that was getting a lot of backlash among the left, among progressives and leftists. And a mutual of ours had sent me the tweet. I'm going to paraphrase it. Obviously, I don't have it in front of me and I can't read it verbatim. But you had basically had enough of identitarianism on the left. And you basically just, I don't know what you had been going through at that moment, but you just said like, I don't care about this issue. And it was all like culture war stuff, right? And you basically made it clear that you want to pursue and accomplish economic policies that better the lives of every single identity group that you had listed, and that you find that to be more important. And so our mutual sent it to me to basically say, like, oh, can you believe he said this? And I was like, I agree with him. And this is at a time when you and I are you know, having a little bit of a conflict. So this person probably thought I was going to like tear into you, but I was like, nah, this take is correct. And so I think that has actually grown within me in a way. And especially at a time where I think that the Overton window culturally in America actually has shifted pretty far to the left, to the point of absurdity, in my opinion, where, I mean, I think common sense things like, hey, we should have laws protecting people from squatters, or, you know, hey, if someone or four people are caught with dismembered body parts, dismembered corpses in their apartment, maybe we should detain them until trial. You know, like, that kind of stuff is now protested aggressively by the left, which is insane to me. And what happens is when you experience the backlash for supporting common sense things, if you ask me, and you get rejected by the left, and they keep telling you, you're no longer part of the left. You're a right winger now. Well, when I get that treatment, I know I'm not a right winger, and I know what my principles are, and I'm not going to start identifying as someone who's on the right. But I have seen a lot of self-identified Democratic voters, liberals, who were canceled, for lack of a better word, or who got the kind of treatment that I'm talking about. And I think that what's super intoxicating for a lot of people, because we're social animals, is that the right wing and, you know, the MAGA crowd in particular is incredibly welcoming. You know, funny enough, they seem to understand the power of a broad coalition better than leftists do. And that is so depressing. And so that, I think that's part of the reason why you see an increased percentage of minority voters now supporting Trump. And it's, you know, Latino voters really stands out. Obviously, he's increased his support among African-American male voters in the country as well. And I think it's because, you know, there are some issues that, I'll be quite frank, I was part of this group. I was part of this group of Democrats that was effectively gaslit into thinking that these problems don't actually exist, that they're just exaggerations. Well, it turns out there actually is a migrant crisis, and we didn't realize it until Abbott started sending migrants to Democratic cities. And now that it's abundantly clear, the gaslighting doesn't work as much. And it seems like Trump, even though I don't agree with his solutions, was correct and wants to address it. So I just think there's a lot of mistakes being made right now on the left. And when their only answer to explaining why people support Trump is they're just racist, it leaves much to be desired, and it lacks any real self-reflection or responsibility for some of the missteps the Democrats have made.
Sorry to interject. Real quick, then you can go. I definitely wouldn't, racism would not be the first thing I go to when talking about those people. To me, at this late date, knowing everything about Trump, to really still ride hard for him, I feel like that's not as excusable as it was in 2015 or 2016. Honestly, by like 2018 or 19, a lot of these people, to the extent they were voting for Trump for economic reasons, I felt like they should have kind of woken up a little bit. I mean, we got the 91 criminal charges. His biggest accomplishment was cutting taxes for the rich. He talks about how he wants to suspend the Constitution. We were talking about his foreign policy before. Super hawkish, tried to coup Venezuela, ripped up the Iran agreement, armed Saudi Arabia, now talks about invading Mexico and treating the drug cartels like they're terrorist organizations so we could airstrike them. He talks about banning socialists and communists from coming into the country. So, like, I feel like I take everything you said and I actually agree with a lot of it. I would just say my charitability towards people who are still hardcore ride or die for Trump. I make an exception for people who are like fence sitters type stuff, but the hardcore ride or die for Trump, I just feel like I don't know how to get through to them in any way where I know back in 2015, 16, 17, I felt like if I have a long enough conversation with this person and I lay out my arguments, maybe by the end of it, they'll be a Bernie Sanders supporter. Whereas now it's like, you bring up Bernie Sanders around those people, fuck you. It's just like, they totally shut down. They're not interested really in a debate. Sorry to cut you off.
That's okay. And I wanted to ask you more about your view. You said something that piqued my interest about how you felt the Overton window culturally had shifted really far to the left. And I wonder if you could just expand on that and what you mean specifically, because I think I know what you mean in a certain sense. In another sense, though, you have like, you know, Joe Biden is the president. He went down to the border and was like, hey, Trump, let's do your like border fascism together, you know, and he, you know, was very much back the blue. He funded the police. Obviously, you know, in terms of what's going on in Israel, Gaza, you still have overwhelming bipartisan support for let's stay with Israel. Let's do the genocide. So in terms of elected officials, at least at the national level, it still seems very culturally centrist or even right of center.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. What I'm specifically referring to, though, is where the far left, I think, has increased its power, and it's on a state level and local level. And really, those are the policies that impact your day-to-day life the most. And if you have the audacity to live in a city like Chicago, you're in the south side of Chicago, and you're experiencing the insane number of violent shootings, the increase in violent crime, you know, the lack of a real robust plan in order to improve public safety in those areas. And then you hear from the far left in the areas where they actually have a lot of power in institutions like higher education. And when you hear from the, you know, the heads of these nonprofits argue that like, no, I mean, crime isn't that bad, actually. It's not as bad as it was in the 90s. Look at these national statistics, which is a great way of hiding the reality of what's happening in big cities, right? Look at the FBI data that gives you the national statistics. Yeah, it's incomplete data because it doesn't include, a ton of local law enforcement agencies that just don't cooperate with the FBI in providing data. It'll show that crime is actually down. If you're living in Chicago and you're experiencing the influx of migrants due to the migrant crisis, you're experiencing these daily shootings and violent crime, and all you hear from the Democratic Party locally is that everything is going great, well, that might actually have a radicalizing effect in the other direction for a lot of voters. And I see that happening. And I actually think that that explains some of what we're seeing with an increased support among Latino and Black voters for Trump.
What do you think the right direction is in terms of crime specifically in major cities?
Do what we were all lied about, you know, the reformers wanting to do. So for instance, we need to reform our prisons 100%. Like prisons are absolute like torture chambers that do nothing to rehabilitate people. We need to focus on reforming our prison system so people aren't simply tortured there. So if people aren't tortured there at all, so people are actually given the tools they need to be productive members of society, so they're rehabilitated. We need to invest a lot more money in rehabilitation services because there are a lot of people struggling with addiction in this country who have not been helped by harm reduction, who desperately want to get sober, but don't have the resources or the money to pay for, you know, the exorbitant costs associated with rehabilitation centers. There's just so much that was left on the table. And instead, I feel like the reformers put the cart before the horse, right? With these, I think bail reform can definitely work. And I've seen some municipalities and states implemented in a way that I think makes sense. The way it was implemented in New York was a failure because they took discretion away from judges. So if a judge deems a suspect to be a flight risk or just a threat to public safety in general, they're not able to make that decision to detain them until trial if the crime that they committed is considered a non-serious offense or a misdemeanor. And keep in mind that places like California and New York decided to reclassify all sorts of violent crimes, including in the case of California, things like strangulation and domestic violence, as a misdemeanor rather than a felony. And so I feel like I was personally lied to because I was under the impression that, you know, we would be hyper-focused on ensuring that nonviolent crimes were not treated with the type of, you know, punitive treatment that we've been seeing for many, many decades in this country. But instead of focusing on that, instead of reforming policing, instead of reforming prisons, I just feel like reformers put the cart before the horse and did other things that actually ended up being counterproductive in criminal justice reform. And I think the pendulum is going to swing in the other direction. It's already begun in places like San Francisco. Oregon has now recriminalized drugs in their state because of how disastrous their drug legalization policies were. So we'll see how it all plays out. But I think that it would be a giant mistake, and it's continued to be a mistake, for the left to automatically reject people who also identify as on the left, but have legitimate critiques about how some of these policies have been implemented.
So I think the big issue there from my perspective is the whole notion sort of pretrial detention. Ideally, if somebody commits a violent crime, it's like, yes, they should be arrested. Honestly, there should be like a trial ASAP. And then depending on how serious the crime is and the nature of it, in some instances, lock them up, throw away the key. In other instances, whatever the sentence is, it is. I think the issue, and I'm curious what you think of this, is the concern with pretrial detention that a lot of people have had is like, what is, when somebody commits like a very low level offense and then they get arrested and then they're like rotting away
like
in a jail
in
cell
Island
for weeks
for years.
In like legal limbo where they can't get out. And but like the whole thing is they're just awaiting for their trial and they're just like stuck there kind of. I think that's the big concern. So it's almost like the real issue here is that we need more judges and we need to actually try to get to a point where we get speedy trials so that like we get our answer and get this thing taken care of, right?
Yeah, look, listen, I totally agree that bail reform was necessary. If someone has been accused of committing a legitimate nonviolent crime, right? And I mean legitimate nonviolent crime. I'm not talking about chopping up bodies. Chopping up bodies. Like, guys, I need to feel that I'm not going insane. So be as honest as you want with me. I just need to know that I'm not going insane. If you're caught with a dismembered corpse in your apartment and like literally the plumbing is clogged because of blood and body parts that you tried to basically hide and dispose of, you should probably be in prison until your trial, right?
You should be president. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Yeah. Of course. Of course you should be in prison the whole time for sure. I don't think that's a difficult question.
It's not considered a bail eligible crime in New York. I don't agree with that. Like, so you got to give the judges discretion. I agree with bail reform positively impacting people who have been committed of, you know, crimes that are not violent or serious crimes that put public safety in jeopardy. Let's put it that way. And so that's why I cheerleaded a lot of these policies, not realizing that they were going to be implemented with the most extreme interpretation, without realizing that violent crimes were going to be reclassified as nonviolent, non-serious misdemeanors.
Yeah.
I had no idea that was going to happen. And I feel like they totally lied about everything. And now I'm going to be honest with you. Now I have difficulty trusting the left when it comes to criminal justice reform, because they went way too far and they refused to recalibrate the approach, regardless of how many innocent people get harmed as a result of it.
I've always said that I consider myself tough on crime if I think it should actually be a crime, right? So like war criminals, for example, we let them off scot-free in this country. George W. Bush and Dick Cheney are still waltzing around living life in their multi-million-dollar mansions. The crooks on Wall Street who had fraud as a business model and effectively crashed the economy in 2008 and 2009. These are all things I'm looking to lock them up and throw away the key. And to your point, actual violent crime. Yeah, I mean, that should obviously be handled in a very serious matter. For me, once you get to like on drug stuff, and I'm curious what you think of this, on drug stuff, I'm kind of super libertarian. So I think we should legalize, tax, and regulate all drugs. And it drives me crazy that really we have almost any drug laws in the country. I'm in favor of some kinds of regulation in terms of like potency of the substance and whatnot. But there was a time when we had like every substance was legal in this country. The first time there was a drug law in the book was pretty late into our history. You used to be able to go to the pharmacy and get like fucking morphine, and they used to give it to their kids to make them sleep at night when they were annoying the shit out of them. Mm-hmm. So do you agree with that on the drug front, or what's your take on that?
If we implemented the Portugal model, then yes, I agree. I don't agree with criminalizing people who are struggling with addiction. I also don't agree with allowing, like California has, open-air drug markets, you know, in front of elementary schools. That's something that leads to dysfunction in society. And we need to find actual solutions to help people get sober when they're struggling with addiction, not simply pass out. Like in Los Angeles, there was this nonprofit that got a lot of heat because they received over the course of their existence, they launched in 2020, they had like received grants totaling $13 million. And unclear what they did with that money. The only thing that we've seen is that they were in Skid Row, literally passing out crack pipes. And I don't think that that's the solution at a time when you have people, 100,000 people a year at this point, dying of drug overdoses. We need to find a way to get people the help they need. And I don't think that our public spaces, which our tax money pays for, should be inundated with open air drug markets, which again, we're experiencing here in California. I think it's real easy for someone who's living in the middle of the country and identifies as a progressive and isn't experiencing this to like look down their noses at me for calling all these issues into question. But I don't think it's fair to hardworking people in the state to have to deal with that in our public spaces. And I don't think it's fair to addicts to have to deal with addiction without any real robust help. So if we implement the kind of policies that you see in Portugal, where, you know, there's a stigma to using drugs, like that's the difference. When we implemented some of these more liberal policies or more left-wing policies in regard to drug use and legalization or decriminalization, it seems like stigma is something that's frowned upon, but it turns out that stigma is actually pretty important in persuading people to get the help that they need. So that's a part of it as well.
All right, guys, that was Anna Kasparian. Honestly, we were just getting warmed up, but our TriCaster shit the bed super hard, so we froze. And then Control Room was trying to get it back up, and it honestly took, I mean, it's honestly still not back up when I'm talking to you now. So it's been down for like 15, 20 minutes maybe. So unfortunately, we had to wrap it up. Anna had to go do her production meeting for the Young Turks. And so we weren't able to dig deeper. We were about to dig deeper. I know Crystal was about to ask the question.
About if alcohol should also be a moral stigma. Anyway, enjoyed the combo with Anna.
Yeah, it was a great conversation with Anna. I was going to take it from that question about the drugs. We were going to get into mental health stuff, and I was going to ask about the idea of an involuntary hold, whether or not, you know, at a certain point, if somebody's out there in the streets and they're showing clear signs of having being mentally disturbed and having psychological issues, like what are their rights versus the idea of having mental health institutions that sort of involuntarily hold them to try to get them better with or without their consent? I think that that's a really interesting and deep conversation. So, yeah, we were able to get, what was it, like an hour and 20, 30 minutes out of it or something. And then everything shit the bed. But we want to thank Anna for coming on. It was a great conversation and great discussion. And we'll have her on in the future. And we'll hopefully not have the TriCaster shit the bed at the time. So go and sign up, everybody, on Substack, Crystal Kyle and Friends. Links below. You know the drill. We love you guys. Talk to you later.